Hi, I'm Terry, Instagram's sassy sober mum. Welcome to my podcast, Sober Stories from Everyday People. Bringing you stories from people just like you and I, the aim of this podcast is to share our experiences with drinking and how we got and stayed successfully sober. You can now access most of my coaching and guidance through my Thrive Sober online video course. This is an easy to follow course containing 50 videos with backed up writing and recommendations that can be worked through in your own time. There is a brilliant app that you can download to access the course on your phone or your tablet. You can skip through the course choosing content you most need in that moment, or you can work through them from 1 to 50 in order. You can come back to the learning or redo sections to help with parts of emotional sobriety that you are struggling with. The course covers holidays, summertime, Christmas, socializing, what to read, identifying and coping with triggers, complacency, the 100-day moderation trap, breaking down old beliefs, managing your thoughts, sugar cravings, and plenty more. You will also get a free copy of my Thrive Sober ebook in the introduction section. Visit www.thrivesobercoaching.com/course to learn more or get access. Use coupon code HALFPRICE to get 50% off. I've had so many messages from people that say the ebook and the course together has been the thing to get them over the line and achieving their first 100 days successfully sober. Hello and welcome to Sober Stories from Everyday People. Today I'm talking to Nina. She's from London and she's been sober for 116 days. I know Nina quite well now, actually, because she's part of my wonderful Thrive group and we also work together and have worked together for some of the journey so far. So it's an absolute pleasure, Nina, to have you on my show sharing your amazing story so far.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So I know quite a bit about you, but my listeners don't. So why don't you tell us a bit about who you are so we can get a bit of a feel for who Nina is and what you're into.
Well, I'm obviously Nina, as you said. I am 46. I live in London and I've got two really amazing children, a 10 and a 7-year-old, and a totally wonderful and supportive husband. And I, since this all sort of started, I have really thrown myself into exercise, which I just love, and being outside and reading. I hadn't read a book, and I hope no one's going to judge me here, but for many years, and not just quit lit stuff, but I've really sort of started to love reading again. So that has been brilliant.
Lovely. Yeah. One of the things that's certainly a constant, I think, on this journey in the early days is absorbing that information and getting into the books, because, you know, now there are so many brilliant books out there. But okay, why don't we go back to the beginning for you and describe your life with alcohol and where that all started?
So I grew up in Hong Kong. My parents actually met there, and just sort of a little bit about them is my mum was, an only child, or is an only child, and born into an army, family. She didn't really see her parents. She was at boarding school from a really young age, only saw them once a year, which, you know, is, when you look at how involved like I am and others are with their kids, you're just like inconceivable almost. And then my dad grew up in Denmark, his father died when he was young and his mother married a Canadian gentleman. So that his sort of teenage years and further on from that were in Canada. But they met in Hong Kong in their early 20s. And love was struck early, and it all happened very quickly. And they married sort of a year later or whatever, and had my sister, and then 2 years after that had me, and then our third the third girl child, my younger sister, came 9 years later. So yeah, and my, you know, my early childhood was really happy. My parents seemed really happy, and I never particularly noticed or was aware of my mum drinking. I mean, Hong Kong was very sociable and there was alcohol around, but it was sort of, yeah, it seemed fun, and we would be involved and sort of see our parents' friends at these parties and come down in our matching night dresses and just, you know, cuteness overload kind of thing. And then my older sister went to boarding school, and I soon followed a year or two later. And so I wasn't sort of around my parents that much at that point. And again, as I said, I was never aware of my mum drinking. But when my sister left that school, which was in the depths of the south of England, I was really unhappy. And she was really my protector and my, you know, my sort of comfort blanket in a way. You know, not having your parents around was difficult, but having her there made it better. And then so when she moved on to senior school, I really, really struggled. And I wasn't a confident person like my sister. I was really quiet. I was quite badly bullied. And I just couldn't quite fend for myself in a way. So my parents decided to take me back to Hong Kong, at which point I was thrown into, not thrown literally, but was in a very large, 1,000 pupil high school, essentially a mixed high school. So it was quite a different thing, but I felt so happy that I was at home. But that really was when things slightly changed, in that my mum was drinking at that point, and it's just not something that I had ever really remembered or sort of come across. My dad travelled quite a lot with his job, and so I was really aware of it. But because it sort of almost felt like it had come from nowhere, I was like, oh, okay. And I do remember there was a time when I was there just for that year in Hong Kong for schooling, that of my best friend's mum had to come over to the house because my mum, she just wasn't very well, or she just was quite absent. And I still didn't really know what was going on, but there seemed to be people that were jumping in to sort of help out. And so that year was strange for me, because I don't remember loads of it, but I do remember those parts of the drinking. And my younger sister was so much younger, and my older sister was away. But then, you know, what happened after that is I then decided that I would join my sister at this other secondary school, which was amazing. And it's funny, if I've ever had any kind of therapy or anyone in that position ever asked, oh, you know, did you feel abandoned by your parents? No, I did not. I loved it. And I have the best friends that I still have today. And we're all each other's godmothers to each other's kids and stuff. You know, the friends I've made there were family, and they, you know, lived through all this stuff that happened at that point, which was, you know, my mum's drinking really escalated then. And her and my dad would sort of, it would separate and then get back together. And then she was in two treatment centres and a secondary care place over those sort of first couple of years of me being at school there. And we'd go and visit her in these treatment centres. And the one thing I always really remember was, at the time, you know, I was fairly young, and you could smoke inside, and there were people that would sort of go in there and never smoked in their lives, and then would smoke in there. So me and my sister were like, this is great. We're out of school. We're seeing our mum. We met loads of really nice people at this treatment centre, and we can smoke. So, you know, we didn't go often, but it was really nice. And they would have meetings for the children and families of, and so we could sort of share and thing, and that felt comforting. But you know, for us, it was, she would come out and things would be fine, which, you know, sort of did and didn't happen, in that she, my parents then totally separated. I was about 14, and she was living in London and relapsed quite badly. And actually the final thing was that she was hospitalized, and then we didn't see her for quite a few months after that. I think my dad just felt that it was pretty sort of close to the bone as such, and he just wanted to protect us from that. And my younger sister was still so young at that point. But she, you know, she went into the hospital, came out, and that was it. That's the last drink she had. And that was 31 years ago. And she's part of a great community, and, you know, I'm really, really proud of her. But obviously those early years were a bit disjointed, in that, you know, my dad was sort of this constant, but we were here, he was there. It was all a bit higgledy-piggledy, which worked in some ways, but definitely didn't work in other ways. So, yeah, and then in terms of sort of growing up in Hong Kong and places like that, you know, my dad was definitely quite strict. But that place is an easy place for a teenager, because it's safe. You know, at that point, you know, things like drinks were not expensive. We would go to these sort of various bars. I mean, I don't even know how they were letting children literally of that age in, you know, doing the shots and all this stuff, and you know, going to these like seedy bars and like parts of Hong Kong that, like, I don't even know how we came across them. We would get on the underground and like go and sit and drink like whiskey chasers and Southern Comfort and lemonade. That was one of my favorites. And we would just like sit in there, and the weather was gorgeous outside, and we'd sit in these like gross bars just getting drunk, and then getting on the tube and all saying goodbye and then going home. I mean, so, but it was easy there, you know, you just sort of went off and did your own thing. It was a fun place to live. But I think that, you know, being an expat for both adults and kids, it was quite a sort of free flowing place. And actually one of my earlier memories of that, I must have been about 13. We used to go to this New Year's Eve party, and it was in this restaurant, and the parents would sit on one floor and the kids would sit on another floor, so obviously no eyes on you, at which point we're all high-fiving each other, we're like woohoo, smoking in the stairwells and all this. And me and my sister definitely had more than we should have, and we got into my dad's car, and the only way to get home was down these kind of windy roads, and I mean, I'm smiling now, but it really was not funny at the time. So first of all, and how I have a memory of this, I don't know, but I was sort of screamed stop, got out, was sick on the side of the road, and all I remember is seeing my dad's legs like by my head, you know, you can just, and sort of almost feel the thunder over you, like, God, I'm gonna be in so much trouble. And then I heard, and then looked over, and there was my sister. Anyway, we got back in, then it carried on in the car, went to bed. And the next morning, my dad came in, and I'd obviously been sick in my sleep. And he was, A, really worried because I could have choked, firstly. And then once he realised I was okay, up, out, clean my car. And that memory of sort of leaning into that car and clearing up was horrible, but of course it didn't stop me, you know. I mean, I drank again, didn't I? So half of me is like, would that not have been the bit where you just went, I'm never doing that again? No. So I did obviously drink again, but that was definitely a really this memory that always comes back to me. And then at boarding school, I mean, again, like, people think you're sort of, you know, Hogwarts locked away and that's it and you can't do anything. Oh, no, no, we found a way. We would drink in fields. We would, in the sixth form, we'd go to the pub, this one pub called the Hole in the Wall, nice name. We knew no teachers would go in there because it was so gross. And I was a sports woman, lady girl, you know, I was in all sorts of teams. And I wasn't, the academics weren't the most sort of high for me, but the sports were my thing. And I, once I got into sixth form, I gave up the sport and I said to my parents that it was because I had to focus on my A-levels, my exams to get me into university. But it wasn't that at all. It was just to free up my weekends. And those weekend sessions in that, not just the Hole in the Wall, but other pubs, I mean, we were talking to random people, you know, we were 16, 17 and, you know, just not cool to be sort of sitting in a pub with grown adults on a Saturday afternoon or whatever. But again, you know, I was quite overweight when I was that age and I was really insecure. And although I was the funny one and the one that would sort of, you know, I didn't feel insecure in that I needed booze to get me out of my shell, but I definitely wanted to be involved in the laugh and the you know, and yeah, I was quite sort of conscious of how I looked. And I guess I didn't know, it was a disguise and all that stuff with my mom, and it was a coping mechanism. But yeah, and then I moved to London after I left school and decided to defer my university. So I went traveling, but in that section of being in London, I lived at my dad's place, so he wasn't charging me rent, and anything I earned was going towards this trip. But you know, London, when you've got to that age of 18, you know, it and you've got a bit of cash, you know, there was things every day, every night, parties, things at weekend. Parents were sort of coming and going, and we were 18, so it wasn't as sort of a strict a thing. But at which point my mum had remarried and she'd moved out of London, and again everything was really disjointed. I didn't feel particularly like I had I obviously had a really loving home, and both my parents were great, but, and my mum was sober and all the stuff, but I didn't have a home, proper home, you know, like my growing up home kind of thing. Then I traveled around Southeast Asia, Australia, New Zealand, all those places. I mean, and that kind of year out thing was fun, but let's put it this way, I partied hard. And you're anonymous. You're more anonymous. I mean, I was with my friend, and she was a lot more sensible than I was, in terms of consumption and just general behaviour. But she was good. You know, she was a good person to go with me. And then got back and went to university, which again, you know, as many people I've heard of on podcasts, and also just speaking to friends, and when you get to university again, like, you're a young adult, you live in halls, no one's telling you when to come home. And I mean, although I had a little bit of that anyway, and I know, you know, boarding school, like, as I said, some people think you're sort of slightly locked up and sort of a wall is around you, but there are freedoms really there, and you're away from home. So going away to university didn't bother me. I made some really good friends, and you know, we were on the hooch, we were on the Vodka Red Bulls. There was always a deal to be had. Wednesday nights that club, Monday nights that club. And I was doing hospitality management, and I always had my sort of more hands-on practical lessons on a Tuesday. So after the Monday night and getting in at whatever, in my second week. The first week we did napkin folding, which my dad was like, sorry, what is going on? You're napkin folding. Is that what you're doing at uni? And I'm like, you've got to know how to napkin fold. Anyway, the next week it was whiskey tasting. So yeah, it was even brought into the into the classroom. Oh yeah, no, we tasted all sorts. But you know, after the Monday night, you're like, ugh. But in my last year, I got really, really severe anxiety, and I had a panic attack in a lecture, and I just could not sort of shift that fear of it happening again. And it was definitely on a really, really bad hangover. I had to leave the room. Obviously, I felt awful. I was sick. It was really bad. So I actually deferred that term and went back the next semester after the summer holidays, which was calmer. But that, yeah, the lead up to that, I think so much of that was to do with alcohol. I think my body was just like, no, you can't, you just gotta stop and slow down, which I did for a bit. I moved in with my dad and I had a month or two, and I was kind of a hermit. I didn't go out that much, and I didn't deliberately not drink, but I definitely took a step back, and in a way it was quite good. I my dad and I became really close then, but I did not ever contemplate not drinking again after that. I was worried about the panic attacks, but it was fine. And then after that, I did a computing course because I didn't learn any computing skills at uni. And then I started working for a drinks company, a healthy drinks company, which was in its really, really early days. And my God, that was so fun. I mean, it was a healthy drinks company, but we definitely had a lot of fun when we were not drinking fruit drinks. We were adding vodka to them. We hosted quite a few parties, and there was always the bar which had our drinks and then the vodka next to it. Or like, I remember we did like a sampling sort of promo thing at a really, really good university, and me and my friend went along, and all these sort of young, well, they were in probably their first year, so they were like 18, and we had this whole stand of all these healthy drinks, but we'd created this cocktail with them. And so I, you know, now I'm looking back, I'm like, that's ironic, really healthy, and then let's shove in loads of vodka, get you really drunk and make your puke bright red or orange or whatever the color was. And yeah, but that was really fun. And again, big fun parties. They did this like sort of music festival thing. And I was working with one of my really, really best friends. And that time there was, I think I was the 18th person to join, and there were 40 something when I left, and it was a really good time. But yeah, it was London early 20 year olds, you know, life of amazingness. Like, we just had such a great time. And then I moved to a consultancy up in the West End of London, and yeah, that again was really fun. But the culture, I assume it's not like that now, but it definitely was. Friday night beers, you know, if you stay like past 6 o'clock on a Thursday, let's get the beers out. That there was a big fridge with lots of milk and soft drinks and stuff for cereal and everything. And then there was a section with the beers. And actually the parties at that company, of which I have to say I organized two, and they were amazing. But yeah, I mean, the budget was the budget, but at least three quarters of that budget was for the booze. Yeah. And you know, you see sites and you see photos of, like, you can't unsee your colleagues doing silly things. You know what I mean? But yeah, no, there was one night after one of those parties, and it was at my boss's house in North London. And I lived in South London. So I got on the bus with a group of people, and like everyone was like, we were just all past it, and they were all going on. And I was never one of those people. I would just go home. It would never be like, Nina's the last one standing, or do you remember what last night when we were still in that club at 3? I mean, no. I'd be home in bed because I'd had too much. But there was one time I left those guys. They all went to a club or whatever, and I went to Victoria Station, and I thought, do you know what? I'm just going to get some wine for either the train or when I get home. And do you know what? I didn't even try and buy a big bottle. I tried to buy a miniature, like a 250 mil, and they wouldn't serve me. And I, at the time, I was like, that's so, you know. But then when I told my colleagues the next day, what do you reckon their reaction was? It wasn't like, oh my God, you'd had enough. Like, why did you try? No, they went, oh my God, that's hilarious. Oh my God, did you hear what happened to Nina? The Victoria Station, they get, and everyone was laughing and everything, you know. And that's what you did when someone had something bad happen, or sort of ended up doing something or kissing someone in the office they shouldn't have. It was all fun. Everyone talked about it and it was really funny. And at no point did anyone ever say to me or each other, oh my God, that's not great. Do you think you better slow down a bit? Mm-hmm. Never. Yeah, in my sort of late 20s, just before I turned 30, I broke up with someone that I'd been with for a few years. And so I lived on my own. I bought a little flat and a studio flat, and you could literally touch my dining table from my bed. Quite useful if you wanted a quick lunch or a midnight feast or whatever. But I did have people over for dinner, and there was one time a friend of mine got really pissed and he said to me, if I just lean back on my chair, I can literally fall onto your pillow and go to sleep. And I was just like, ha ha, just because you live in a two-bedroom flat. But that flat was really special because it was mine and I owned it and I worked hard for that. And I had some really amazing memories there, but I had some pretty bad memories there too. Because I lived on my own, I could do what I wanted. I didn't have to check in with anyone, whether I was out late or if I stayed at a friend's or whatever. I could have as many people back. I didn't, you know, and I'd never really had that. I'd either always had a flatmate or lived with family but yeah, there was a little Sainsbury's local near my flat, which I passed the other day, and that's why I mentioned it in this, but I always used to get wine on the way home because the bus stop was right outside. They'd always have deals on, always. And one of the guys still works there, and I saw him the other day and I thought, I wonder if he remembers. I mean, if I had a spreadsheet of how much booze I bought in that Sainsbury's, I mean, we'd be clicking through pages and clocking up a lot of cash. So that Sainsbury's, yeah, it was my go-to thing. And I, you know, sometimes I'd be like, oh God, I bought two bottles there the other day. They might think that. So I'd go along to somewhere else. But I mean, generally that was my place. And if I ran out of booze, no one was in my flat to say to me, you've probably had enough. I'd go, great, I'm just going to go to Sainsbury's to go and get another bottle or whatever. So that was, and I think the drinking alone thing, when you live alone, it's not some people's vibe. It was definitely mine. Mm. I was like, I've had a really tough day at work, or, you know, I was single, but I was fine. I wasn't like, I need a boyfriend, I need to get married. But a lot of my friends were getting married, they were having children. And I always used to do dry Jan, and I went to dinner with a few friends, and one of my friends said, oh God, don't be so boring. You're, you know, kind of insinuating I was boring when I didn't drink. But I stuck to my guns on that. And there was always that little thing in my head is, well, if I can do that, then I don't have a problem. And yes, this and that. But I do think when you live on your own, there was also something that felt a bit naughty about it. I'm not going out. but I'm being a bit naughty. I'm going to get a whole packet of fags, open the window to my flat, which was on a main road. Lovely. And there I was smoking and having the red vino. And but yeah, I mean, I did have a great few years, and I felt independent and I felt empowered. But I know lots of people that would never drink alone, but I definitely did. And there was one time I went to my local doctor, and I was going in for something, I don't know, maybe not a flu jab, but I mean, it was a very specific appointment. And he said to me, "You really smell of alcohol." And I was like, "Oh, well, you know, I had a few friends around last night." So yeah, and actually I sort of had to fill out a form, and he gave me a leaflet that said, you know, there's a lady here called, I can't remember, let's say Angela. She comes in on a Tuesday. If you need any help from her, this leaflet tells you everything that you need to know. And I think perhaps maybe you might want to think about it. But you see, I hadn't realized, I'd forgotten that when I first joined that practice, I filled out the form and I was honest. I mean, who the hell is honest about how much they drink? I was probably hungover. I was probably like, oh, that's right. Oh, whatever. Anyway, so he had the information. He smelt me, handed me the leaflet. Yeah. And I, until this day, talking to you, I have never told anyone that.
Yeah. Wow.
And I then went back to see that man with my son for something else years and years and years and years later. And I sort of sat there and I was like, look at me, I'm now married with a baby and I'm really sensible and I don't need to see that lady. And I never did, by the way, obviously. But yeah, and so that was the early bit. And then I met my husband, who, as I said in the beginning, is amazing and supportive and a wonder of a man, which I didn't think would happen to me. I was a bit blue at one point. I thought, oh, it's happening to everyone else. Where's my hunk? Where's my man? Not that that would have made it all better, but I kind of felt that it was like my time. And there he was. And no one had ever made me feel like he did and still does. He immediately poured on the love. Flowers were sent, smooth operator. But he was living in America and he made me feel really secure, like even though he wasn't here. And it worked well because I was still a dependent. He would come into London, we'd like go out, we'd drink and eat and just have a lovely social time. But then I could still do my own thing, still be in my flat and drink wine by myself, but then kind of feel this huge love bubble of amazingness. And I really love my job and I love my friends and I, you know, but it all happened really quickly because we were a bit older. And as I said, he was living abroad. And so we got engaged a year later. He asked my dad after, I think, 5 months. So my dad was like, what's happening? You asked me months ago, what's happening? So I think he was a bit worried that, you know, it wasn't serious, which it was. And then we got married in London. And then 2 months later, I got pregnant and had our little boy, and I couldn't breastfeed. So in one way, I felt really, really sad about it. And it took me a while to get over that. But in another way, I could be more independent and my husband could help with night feeds or, you know, and I could drink. And we took our son to the pub when he was, I don't know, maybe 5 days, really young, really young. And our friends were like, oh, you're so cool, you know. Maybe they didn't use the word cool, that's a bit 90s. But, you know, they were like, he's here, there's the baby. You're such a great mum. You're up and about and in the pub and glorify, 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 get the wine. You haven't changed. You've got to have had a baby, but you're still fun. And then after that, we very sadly, I found out I was pregnant 2.5 years later. And we found out the baby had a syndrome. And I gave birth, but effectively lost the baby at nearly 5 months. So that was really hard. And, you know, my drinking was pretty consistent, but it really ramped up then.
Mm.
And I think that that sense of loss and also so many people knew I was pregnant, although I didn't have a huge bump. The 3 month scan was done. Everyone knew. And it was, you know, and that the whole process of how that was dealt with by the hospital and everything surrounding it was awful. And we went on holiday quite soon after, and I just drank. I mean, I drank at, not at breakfast, but I drank from about 11:30 midday onwards.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I was a lot younger than I am now, and I didn't ever really remember feeling terrible or hungover and stuff like that. But it was just like, let's just push this down, block it out, and get on with it.
Yeah.
And my husband didn't do that on that holiday. I mean, he had some wine here and there, but it was not like me. And I cherished my son so much, and I really took me a while to decide whether we'd have another baby. And my husband was like, if you don't want to, I will 100% support your decision. You know, there's no rush. And there wasn't a major rush, but I was, you know, I was definitely edging into my late 30s. So then I just thought, do you know what? In the name of bravery, let's do it. Let's try. Let's see. And I got pregnant. I mean, thank goodness, and I feel so grateful, but really quickly. And our daughter came along 9 months later, and she is so amazing. And I quite often look back on that time and think, if I'd had that child, I wouldn't have her. Yeah. And so when I now have all these sort of sober glimmer moments, and I had one the other day, which I told you about with the flower picking, you know, my son gives me tons of glimmers all the time, of course, but she, you know, I just feel so lucky to have her. But again, went to the pub when she was 4 days old. Same kind of thing. And then the next really, really major stint of all of this, as with thousands of people around the world, it was COVID. And I'm not telling a story that's any different to many, but we could drink whenever we wanted. And I was homeschooling, but my son was only in reception. So it's not like he was having big exams or anything that was going to get him into, you know, some university in a far off land. We just had to do whatever phonics here and there. You know, we had a family member with us, and it, you know, anyway, we made sure there was enough wine in the house because we didn't know how long it was going to last. So we just ordered like loads. And then my husband was like, it's fine, whatever we don't drink, we'll just sort of put it aside. And of course we drank that in, oh God, I don't know, 2 weeks. We were drinking every night. And then we would make things like, oh, it's Burns night. Ah, let's have a whiskey and a bottle of red wine. Oh, it's St. Patrick's Day. It's Chinese New Year. It's whatever. I'm not joking. We literally celebrated everything. Then it was his birthday. Then it was my birthday. Then it was my third cousin's birthday. No, not quite. But, you know, we were like going for gold on the celebrations. We'd have Zoom parties. We'd have girls' nights. We'd have boys' nights. We'd have quiz nights. We'd have anything, and then sit in the garden in that glorious sunshine with rosé in like a beaker kind of thing. I mean, what? Anyway, so we all just about got through that, but that was daily, and I wasn't into exercise then, so I didn't care. I mean, I went out for my hour, but I just wanted to get back on the rosé. And then, you know, after all that, you know, it's the play dates, isn't it? Look around. Okay, which mom's on the booze? Okay, fine. I'll gravitate towards her. Parties. Oh,
is there Prosecco? Oh no, there's no booze at this one. Oh God, it's so annoying. I'm just going to have to drink water. I mean, that kind of thing going through your head. Pizza Express, our beloved Pizza Express. How many times have I been there? I can't even count. But I've been there with my kids on my own and ordered wine. Not just one, two, maybe more. And those things I'm not proud of. I'm not proud of that at all. And you know, things like traveling, you get to the airport, oh, well, everyone else is drinking. My friend drinks on flights. Every flight I'd ever used to go on, even if it was 1 hour to Scotland.
Yeah.
Get the drinks in. Yeah. Where's the trolley? I'm feeling a bit nervous, so I'll just drink. Mm-hmm. But my traveling anxiety definitely with age has got a lot worse. So yeah, there we go. That's not to date, because I've got obviously more to say, but that is my describe your life with alcohol in a rather long-winded way.
Yeah, a lot of similarities. Of course, we're very, very close in age. We both suffered, you know, late losses. You were 5 months. I was four and a bit months. And I don't think anybody, unless you've been through that, that nobody really understands that darkness.
Mm.
And I drank very heavily through that as well. And I still think it's a subject as well that we don't talk about enough, really. All the fertility stuff, to be honest. I think there's a lot of unexpected disappointments and trauma in the journey to have children. It's not straightforward and linear for everybody, and there are many people that have many challenges. But yeah, it's we've talked about this obviously, but it is, you know, there's quite a lot of chaos for you really early on, especially very early on. And so thinking about or talking about the time when you got to that point where you said enough, just talk me through that. What helped you come to that decision?
Yeah, I mean, there were definitely times where I knew deep in my soul that this was a problem of some sort. I never lay in bed thinking I'm an alcoholic, or I'm not a big fan of that particular word, but I mean, obviously everyone is different. But where it really hit me was last year. I went into the throes of perimenopause, and whenever people talked about it before, one of my really best friends is like a fountain of knowledge on it, and my older sister. And I didn't poo-poo it, but I was like, yeah, God, yeah, fine. You've got a headache and you're this and that, whatever. But then this time last year, April last year, I started getting these awful headaches, and I just never had them apart from when I was pregnant or when I had COVID. So I either thought it was hormonal or something more sinister. Everything was checked out, and luckily it was not sinister. But I then went on to very low dose of HRT, and it seemed fine for a while. But the how my drinking changed was one glass, maybe two, could do anything from, oh, I feel really great, don't think anything of it, to, oh my God, I feel awful the next day. Like I have, oh, terrible hangover, or, you know, one glass and I'd be like Garfield, the eyes would go, I sort of looked like I was stoned, or which I wasn't, by the way, but I, you know, I just felt so un myself. And, you know, I was definitely not, as I said, not one of the ones that would be the last one standing, but I could last past a glass of wine or two, and I would just get so tired. And, you know, the sleep, as we all know, the sleep was so destructive. And the sleep for me, I was then craving more sleep. And so I would just do things like, you know, if I had a few drinks in the early evening, I'd then go to bed really early because I was so desperate to catch up, inverted commas, but I never would. And I think that with the perimenopause thing came the anxiety. And not just anxiety as I knew it in my past, but anxiety that I didn't know, a different kind. And it was so sort of deep in, and I didn't know how to deal with it. And so by drinking more and sort of covering that, it would put a plaster on it for a bit, but then I never knew what the next day was going to be like. So then I would get anxious about things that I didn't know, would I feel okay for that? Could I go to that meeting without feeling like that? Or I won't drink for that night because I've got that tomorrow. I was cancelling things. I was cancelling things and, you know, not lying, but I was sort of saying, oh, can we just do it another time? And I think that was the anxiety fueled because I did not know. I had no control of how I'd feel. And sometimes I'd feel fine. Sometimes I wouldn't. Sometimes I'd feel sick. Sometimes I'd be sick in the middle of the night. I mean, it was so unpredictable. So I was anxious of feeling anxious. Crazy. And I just thought about it all the time. Should I drink? Should I not? Da, da, da. And then in December, we went away after Christmas and I was feeling really bad. And my husband was really worried about me. And he said, you just don't seem yourself. And I said, I don't feel myself. I don't know myself. And I called the gynecologist and she slightly changed my HRT. And he said, oh, but it's not working. And I said, yeah, but it can take months. And anyway, we were away on this holiday and we had a really long day with some friends and we drank tons and got back to the hotel and bumped into this couple we'd met by the pool. And at the hotel, they were showing a movie on the beach on this little screen. And my son said to me, can we watch it? The Grinch, whatever it was. And I said, no, because it doesn't start till 9. At this stage, it was 7:30. And I knew how much we drank and I wanted to go to bed, but we were just having a nightcap or two. And he said, oh, mommy, please. And I said, no, you're not. You're not watching that. Because I knew if you watched it, that would go until 11. And he was like, huffy and puffy. And then he put his arm around my daughter and he said to her, don't worry, they'll just order 5 more bottles of rosé and then she'll say yes. And I literally, it was like this thing went into my, I put my drink down and I went, right, we're going to bed. And he looked at me and he went, what? Mummy, no, we've only just had dinner. And I said, we're going to bed now. And I said to my husband, we're going to bed. And he was like, what? Totally confused. We just ordered drinks. I said, no, we're all tired. We've had a long day. And I lay in bed that night and I joke you not, I did not sleep. The anxiety was running and riding all through my body. And I was like, what the hell? I drank the next day, obviously. But it sat on my shoulders. And 2 days later, we went for dinner, having had like just one glass of rosé at lunch. But that night at dinner, I didn't drink. It was the 3rd of January. And my husband was like, are you okay? Are you okay? And I got back to the room and I burst into tears. And I just said, I don't know what it is. I don't know what's wrong with me. And he was just amazing. And it wasn't related to booze. It was very much the perimenopausal stuff. But he said, why did we do dry Jan and Feb? And it was literally like this weight came off my shoulders. I burst into tears. I went, yes, please. I want to do that. Got into bed, wake up the next day. And I haven't had a drink since then.
Oh,
yeah.
It's amazing. I almost felt a bit emotional, like hearing, which is crazy because, of course, I know the story. But yeah. I think it's, yeah, I don't know, that, the way you describe those final days, it just takes me back, I think. You know, it just really takes me back to that time when I was in that same place, when I felt just desperate. And I felt despair. I felt desperate. And I just wanted everything to change. And I knew that I had to be the instigator of that. But it was almost like, I don't know, like I needed to, I just, yeah, needed to feel that low.
Yeah.
Take a very, very deep breath, pull my big girl pants up and just be like, right, let's go. Let's go. Yeah. Let's go. Yeah. Even though this is like overwhelming and scary, let's just go.
I mean, I didn't know. I didn't know at that point I was kind of in it for the long haul. Do you know what I mean? Like I didn't, I know a lot of people say take each day and stuff like that, but I, you know, I got back and I listened to your 100 episode, which is all about your story. And that for me was like, oh my God, that sounds like me. Oh, that sounds like me. Oh my God, that's me. Oh my God, there are other people out there. So that was, yeah, listening to your podcast was that I didn't even know there were podcasts about sobriety or Instagram or really books or anything else in this amazing space. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that as well, it's just, thinking about how far you've come in 116 days from that point and how much your life has transformed. You know, the transformation has been rapid at times along this path of, you know, a very, you know, a big amount, but also a very short time, you know, short 116 days, right? It's amazing how much can change in that time. But, you know, talk to me about what that was like in the beginning for you. Let's go back into those first weeks of the beginning of your journey and the things that you did and the things that were coming up for you
at the
time.
My day one was back with our friends and I could have drunk then. I mean, it was that in my head is we would get back to England and that was when the dry Jan started, but I just didn't want to drink that day and I didn't have a hangover. I just was like, I just don't want to. So my flight back was really, you know, I hadn't really been on a flight where I hadn't drunk. And I wasn't sort of getting drunk on the plane, but you know, ordinarily I would have had a couple of drinks. So that was really calm. And yeah, I just sort of did stickers with my daughter and, you know, it was just a really calm flight. And then once I listened to your podcast, I went onto your website and I did a bit of investigation and found some books. And I basically sort of created a library. I mean, I think in the first batch of books there was this big Amazon pack and I was like, I've ordered all these books, but of course I'm not going to read them in 4 days. And the children would say, Mummy, what's that book about? And I'd say, oh, it's about wellness. And they were really into that. And then I started doing the couch to 5K. And then booked in a sponsored run 3 months later. It was an Easter weekend for Macmillan Cancer for a very dear friend. And I just always had my ear pods near me. And I know I've said this to you. And you said you were the same. If I didn't have them, I'd be like, where are they? Where are they? I can't listen to anything. And I was like, you know, I mean, I literally had them in any moment I could, and or if I was like, if I've treated myself to a little bath, I'd have one in the background, or if I'm walking to the school, I'd have one, or if I was cycling to the gym, the fitness thing was definitely very much part of that 100 days. And I had tried that couch to 5K before and failed because either I was hungover or I didn't, and I was a lot heavier in my weight, and it's been a journey over a couple of years, but this last bit has come off since I've stopped drinking. And so, you know, I also found your community, did your course, the Thrive course initially, and then
I was like, I'm going to join the community. And I was pretty nervous. Mm. So that wasn't right at the beginning. And the journaling didn't start right at the beginning. That started when I went on our first holiday in February, half term. And so I kind of wish I had started in the early day one or day two, because then I could have really gone back to that. Although I remember those feelings, and actually the feeling of relief and elation and you know, just I just felt, I wasn't nervous, I didn't feel sort of scared, I just felt at ease and in some way at peace and really confident. And those first 100 days I then told some really good friends and my family. I remember it was a Sunday and I called them individually. Not like it's some massive announcement, like I'm going to be the new prime minister or whatever, but I mean, it was big to me. And they were amazing. And actually both my sisters are sober too. So I wanted to join the gang. I wanted to be with the girls of the family. And they've been so great. And my husband, from day one, he's just, you know, I know some people don't have a great support network or they, you know, they might feel that they don't have that structure at home. And I know at this point, I'm really lucky to have that. So I think, and I really told him about what I was doing. I was like, you know, I've got this book and I'm, but not sort of laying it on thick. But he did it too. I mean, he's done 100 days and he's just sort of happily seeing how life is and working and stuff. And yeah, but those first 100 days, there were bits of difficult times and little senses of loss or being a bit overwhelmed, but generally I just felt so happy and just like so confident in what I was doing because I knew it was the right thing.
Yeah. And I think that that is such a great point when you click into the right gear. It is easier, I think, to get going, but it takes a while to click into that gear. And I think like you, I've had many, 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 many opportunities to change my relationship with alcohol in my life since I was 14. I've had many times that I probably should have done it. Mm. And I've even had stints of where I'd been sober and I'd gone back. Even though I tasted the elixir of sobriety, I went back. When you step into that energy, when you sort of get into that place where you're just ready, the timing is right, and it means a lot to you to get this thing, to get it done and to do it, do the work and to take on the challenge, because it is a big challenge, you know. It's you know, when you were talking earlier about your workplace, I remember so much when I worked in sales, you know, big open plan office in the center of Bournemouth. Everybody went out Wednesday, Thursday, Friday night, sometimes Friday into Sunday morning. You know, it's just crazy culture, but everybody laughed about it. It was like, on Monday morning, was I going to go in and be laughing at someone else, or was I the one that was going to be the topic of, you know, the fun taking? But I remember during that time, the anxiety got too much for me, and I would have these pangs of, I just don't think I could do that. And I would confide in people. And I felt like quite often that was just kind of getting brushed off as me being a bit, you know, being too deep about it or being over the top. Like, come on, don't be ridiculous. You're fine. Your drinking's fine. And it just not being validated. And it was very easy to, and it still probably is, very easy to just stay trapped in on that Ferris wheel because of the conditioning, because so many people are still very caught up in drinking, and it's the social lubricant. It's the way we have fun. It's the way we cope with loss. It's the way we, you know, it's the dance we dance every time, right? Even at home on our own for many of us. So it is a big challenge to take that on and to face all of that and to face that that you've always known and to turn your back on it and say, no, I want to learn how to do it a different way, even though I don't know what that road looks like. I have to build that road as I go. Right. That's like, that's really, really hard. And so for you, like, what have you learned about yourself in that 100 days? What things have surprised you?
Well, I definitely think I feel more confident, which is always something that I struggle with, but also the resilience and the, you know, not just with the exercise and stuff, but, you know, having a goal and doing it. And I, you know, I'm not one of those people that is going to say to you in 6 months that I've, you know, I'm going to go and run 20 marathons or whatever, but that's okay. Like little steps. And also, you know, I live near a park, and even on those really cold mornings and stuff, you know, I'm proud of myself. The fact that I'm not a natural runner. It just isn't something that I love it now but it's mainly about how it makes me feel and the dopamine and all that stuff. And I just feel really, you know, I just feel really fulfilled by it. But my main thing really of all of this, and it was absolutely from day one up to present, it is how much more time I've got and the stuff that I do with the children. And I mean, I am definitely a better mother for other people, but definitely for myself. Like I've got a routine and I stick to it I'm not letting people down. I mean, I never let people down in certain circumstances. I'm very much known as very reliable and I'm involved in the kids' school and all that stuff. But like with what Claire Pooley said in her book, you know, there's sort of school gate stuff. And really there's stuff that people don't know about each other. And it's not that I was, you know, passing out every night and couldn't function and all the rest of it, but it's day-to-day stuff. And some of it is quite glorified. And I don't want to glorify some of my behavior. It was not right. And it wasn't right for me or my family. And that is the main thing really. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that you have been so open as well in this process. And I don't know whether that surprised yourself or whether you're always, you know, like that, but you've really opened yourself up to, you know, the community and sharing your stories and showing up for yourself, coming to the Zoom meetings or, you know, the times that we've worked together. Everything we explore, you grab hold of, you know, with both hands. You're in and you want to give it a good go and you just have that a big enthusiasm for that. And I think that has really allowed you to go deep and find, you know, where are the challenges and let's look at the challenges and let's face them. And, you know, for you, what have been the hardest bits, do you think, so far?
I think one thing you'd said to me when we started our sessions is make space, make time. I've really tried to do that, but when it has been more difficult, if it's holidays or you know, circumstances change, if my little bubble of all of this has broken a little bit, I find that hard because I like it. I've got used to it and my go to bed at that, not every night, because you know, I do actually have a life, but go out, journal, do this, do that. But I don't get het off about it. I'm like, if I can't do that at that time, or I can't journal at that time, or I can't listen to that lovely breathing, you know, thing at night time, it's okay. Because I don't want to add any anxiety doesn't need to be there. And I, you know, I don't really feel anxious very much, well, hardly ever actually. And I was
you know, it was crippling last year. Mm-hmm. So that I would say, you know, I do find it a bit hard if the sort of my plan of like, I've allowed time for that, or I've made space for that, and it doesn't quite happen. I do find that hard because I want to keep it on the track that I'm going.
Yeah.
There's been a couple of times where, yeah, people's reactions, or body language or demeanor changes and things like that. And I, you know, that was probably 6 weeks, 2 months ago when I did have a, that was hard. And it took me a couple of days to get over it. And I'm, you know, loads of people come across it, and I just had to really dig deep and work through those reactions are really not to do with me. Why would anyone care if I was drinking or not? It doesn't affect anyone else's evening.
Yeah.
You know, am I really so boring that you think that if I have a drink, I become more fun? I don't think anyone's ever described me as boring. And as you can tell from this podcast, and Terry, you know, I love a chit chat. And I love sharing a story, and I love, you know, giving a bit of detail and the odd arm movement. I'm really secure in this, but that what that is, and I know there will be more of that because I've been told by others, and I know I'm not kind of floating on this weird thing where I'm like, everything's fine and everyone's just going to be accepting. I know people will fall off. I know some friends may not like it, or maybe I won't get invited to things. So what? Mm. It doesn't matter. I'm not doing this for anyone else apart from my family and for myself. Yeah. So it is the right decision. Mm. And I'm really fun.
Yeah. Wow. Absolutely. And I think that it takes a little bit of time to feel into that, I think, because in the beginning it is different, and we often go into the journey with our self-esteem or our self-worth a little bit in tatters, a little bit bruised by some of the shame. Absolutely. Of our drinking, and you know, so yeah. We don't often start this journey firing on all cylinders, you know. We come at it from a place of desperation or shame or just not great energy. Like, we want to make a big change because the drinking's aggravating us, and it's not, you know, we're running at 70%. We're aware of the fact that we're not at 100%. And so I think, yeah, it's delicate. You're delicate in the beginning. And even when you do the work and you listen to the podcast and the books and coaching and in the group and sharing your experiences with people that really understand, when people do sometimes throw disdain, how could you stop drinking? Like, what's wrong with you? Are you boring? You know, that can affect us. But through those moments, excuse me, through those moments, you know, we look for opportunity, and it's kind of, how can I digest this, accept how I feel, but also process this in a way that's going to help me next time and support me better. Yeah. Next time. And so much work with that stuff, you know. There's been many of them, you know, just like situations where you have maybe felt out your depth, or perhaps you have worried about what someone might say, or you know what I mean, and I think they're very shaping. And
but also I think what you touched on with the shame thing, which I know I had a wobbly bit a couple of weeks ago, is that that is a hard part, because the fact is that we all have shame. And I said this to you, I can deal with any shame that's to do with myself, but shame to do with anything to do with my drinking and my children is something that is deep rooted. And obviously by not drinking, you're not covering anything up. And so through work, journaling, reading, listening to podcasts, I listened to a great one the other day, and this lady on it was talking specifically about shame. And it really hit a nerve, and I had to stop in the park, put my bike down, and I sobbed, and I sobbed, and I sobbed, and I got home, and I sobbed, spoke to my husband, spoke to a friend, spoke to you. I just, at that point, I was like, I don't know how to deal with this. And I have dealt with it, and I've really dealt with it. And I've completely reframed it. And I don't need to go back to that, the specific thing that I was upset about. So that, yes, absolutely. The hard thing is having to deal with a few feelings that you probably have masked for a bit, not you, me, whoever. Mm. And, but I'm taking them for, you know, head on.
Yeah.
Oh, I want to think about it. I'm not opening some box of shame and going, come all out. Wah! I mean, they're coming out in little bits. I'll open the box every so often, but I'm not letting them flood me. Yeah. Because I want to think about going forward,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, that's right. And everything that you've been through and every version of you that you've been has brought you to this wonderful version that you are today. And it's kind of just keeping that in the forefront, how much you've achieved. It's special. This is your special time. And you will never regret all of this stuff that you're doing. You just yeah. won't. And so on that more positive note, what are the three things that you would share that have been your kind of guiding light moments or practices, or, you know, to help somebody else that is starting out?
Yeah.
What's the day sober?
So I think my, so my biggest sort of gains personally are, and I've just picked out some words which you had set this lovely homework 2 weeks ago about going back to the journal and the words that come up, and they've really kept coming up, and they're going to be in my next 100 days and the next and the next and the next and the next, which are calm, happy, free, present. And this is a bit of a cop out because it's two words, but anxiety free. And other than all the other things that I've gained, the children, that I was playing cricket with my son, not with pads and the helmet or anything at the weekend, but I was doing it, got a couple of sixes. My main sort of sober tip, staying sober tip things for me are, you know, make time for yourself. And even if that is 10 minutes, I people have really busy lives, and that is one thing that I categorically think has helped me through this. Because it's very easy to do things for other people. And we are, a lot of us are parents, or you know, even if you have a stressful job, or you're a child or a grandparent, but just a little bit of time each day and carve it out. I put it in my diary. I literally put it in my diary. So that's one big thing. Obviously, the podcast and reading, I threw myself really early into that. And I've got a little folder which I've sort of created of all the things of those I really love and bits that I've taken out. And I know the journaling is something, and I'm kind of putting that all in one group, but definitely telling a few people, if you just want to tell one person at the beginning, and if you don't, I totally get that too. But for me, obviously I told my husband, and he's just so supportive, and it took me a little longer to tell my family. They knew I was doing dry Jan, but just a group of trusted friends, or, you know, it doesn't even need to be someone in your really tight group of friends, just someone, or reach out to someone in a community or a group. Because I think the power of telling others, and especially in those communities, in like a trusted group, you know, it's a safe space. No one's going to judge you. Everyone has done things that they regret. And that's like with my shame stuff, and I talked about it to the group. I mean, it was just amazing, you know?
Yeah.
So those would be my three things, with a few extra little things.
With a few twinkles.
Little twinkly things in there. So yeah, that would be my three bits at the end.
I love it. Thinking, just before we stop the recording, thinking back to your day one, if you could go back, Nina now goes back to Nina on day one, what would you say? What words of encouragement would you offer?
I would say just keep going, and just have faith in yourself. Like, we are all stronger than we think, and there are really good days, and that, but there are really shit days. Let's not like sugarcoat it. There are days that are hard, but what I always do, and I read it somewhere or listened to it somewhere a few times over, I don't think about being like thinking ahead as an at that pub session or at that. I think about the next morning. I literally think about the next morning. And so many mornings where my husband took the children and gave them breakfast and I would lie in bed till 10 in the morning or whatever, or sort of crawl out and go and, you know, on a bike ride, but really begrudgingly, or thought, oh, I feel sick, all this. And actually, yeah, just looking forward to the next day and just remembering those feelings, because the way that I or lots of people feel at this moment, you know, I don't feel not well or fuzzy headed or tired or any, you know, I sleep well and everything. So I would say to myself, have faith in yourself, keep going, and you can do it. If you put this work in, and the emotional sobriety piece is really important, because a lot of people have willpower. I mean, I know a lot of people that do. But for me, unless I had done that work and I really invested the time into myself, the reading, the podcast, the community, the this, that, really, really put the work in, would I be where I am today? I would hope I'd be sober, but I wouldn't be in such a great place. Yeah. So, yeah. Just have faith and keep going and just know you can do it. Yeah. That's what I'd say to myself.
I love that. Where can we find you? Because you've got a new Instagram page and you're starting to share some of the nuts and bolts of your journey and helping other people, you know, that are, you know, earlier on, which is fantastic. Yeah. So how do we find you?
I was just about to spell it out in phonics, but I won't do that. Wonderfully sober. So yeah, wonderfully sober. And yeah, just a few little nuggets on there. I'm not pretending to be an expert in anything, but I little things like today, I said the last time I just saw sports day go into the calendar at school this time last year. I was sick before I went to sports day, and I spent the whole of sports day looking at the sports field, but really thinking about if I was going to be sick again. So I am very excited about going this year with sparkly eyes and embarrassing my daughter in a good way.
Yeah.
Woo, you can do it.
Yeah. Well,
where's the loo? So yeah, there will be not a trace of vomit in sight.
Oh, I love that though. I love that when those moments pop up. When you think about things in that way, through that lens of how it was before and how it is now and how good that feels. I think that, you know, having those moments daily is a really good thing. And I do think that the more you pay attention to them, the more, you know, that pops up. And it all goes into helping to weave into the tapestry of this, you know, successful time that you're in with this emotional sobriety and connecting everything all together and realizing that how far you've come, you know, you could never go back now where you were and who you were. You've completely changed in a good way. So that's Instagram, isn't it? At Wonderfully Sober. So give Nina a follow, and I'm sure if you dropped her a message, she would be more than happy to give you a bit of wisdom and a bit of love. Nina, it's been such a pleasure to record this today. I'm so excited for your journey. I think you've done amazingly well. And I think a lot of people will get a lot from this story, because, you know, we need to feel the hope that we can get there, I think. Yeah. Humans, especially when we are feeling in this more desperate energy, like, you know, I can't do it, or I want to do it, but how? And to hear stories like yours give us all hope. And I think that's a lovely thing to be able to give to this community. So thank you so much for your time and for being here.
We could have chatted for hours.
Yeah, that's right. It feels quite interesting, like trying to be quite professional, but obviously
Normally we would be chatting all sorts of stuff.
So nice.
But keeping it all very professional on the podcast. Yes. But all right. Thank you, everybody. And catch you soon.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. If you're interested in being a guest, please contact me directly on Instagram by sending a message to @sassysobermum. You can also find helpful tools and resources on my website, sassysobermum.com. If you enjoyed the podcast and you want to spread the love, please like, share, and rate the podcast. I really look forward to next time. See you then.